This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, May 29th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, Walmart workers from across the country make their way to the corporation's annual meeting in Arkansas after walking off the job to demand better wages and fair treatment. Internet activist Jeremy Hammond faces up to 10 years in prison after pleading guilty to hacking into the global intelligence firm Stratfor. And California's largest public employee union calls on the state to investigate JP Morgan Chase and other major banks linked to the LIBOR scandal. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A drone strike in the North Waziristan region of Pakistan killed at least four people today. The number two leader of Pakistan's Taliban, Wali Ur Rehman, is reportedly among the dead, although the group's official spokesperson has not confirmed the death. The drone strike comes less than a week after President Barack Obama pledged in a major counterterrorism speech to limit the use of weaponized unmanned aerial vehicles. The CIA drone program is a sensitive issue in Pakistan. A politician who has criticized the use of drones there will take office as prime minister next Wednesday. In Honduras, rival gangs have proposed a historic truce to reduce violence in the country in exchange for government support of their reinsertion into daily life. Tim Russo reports.
In a press conference held Tuesday at the San Sempredano prison in San Pedro Sula, Honduras, representatives from Central America's most notorious rival gangs, the MS-13, or Mara Salvatrucha, and the M-18, or Mara 18, sat side by side and offered what amounts to a nationwide ceasefire. Honduras has topped the United Nations Organization of Drugs and Crime homicide list with the world's highest murder rate for the last two consecutive years. Authorities claim that gang violence between the Mara Salvatrucha and the Mara 18 is largely to blame and applauded Tuesday's ceasefire offer. President Porfirio Lobo responded to the news, saying that the government would act quickly to take advantage of the historic offer, but details as to how the government will work with the gangs is unclear. Negotiators who helped to broker the first step of this deal, similar to a gang truce signed last year in El Salvador, were Adam Blackwell from the Organization of American States and Monsignor Romulo Emiliani. El Salvador's gang truce has resulted in lower homicide and property crime rates. Tim Russo, FSRN, Chiapas, Mexico.
The state of Colorado has taken further steps to provide a legal framework for the production, consumption, and sale of marijuana. FSRN's Jim Pullen has more.
Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper signed six bills Tuesday related to the taxation and regulation of marijuana and hemp. The bills create a framework for the controlled substances Colorado voters chose to legalize last November. The new laws stipulate recreational marijuana sales will be taxed at a rate of 30%, half by an excise tax and half by a sales tax. Workers can also deduct business-related expenses from their state income taxes, which wasn't previously allowed in the state's burgeoning medical marijuana industry. Another bill, seen in earlier sessions but never passed, specifies a driving under the influence limit, 5 nanograms or more of THC, marijuana's active ingredient, per milliliter of blood. The remaining bills establish penalties for underage users, prohibits the cultivation and consumption of marijuana at daycare centers, adds marijuana to the Indoor Clean Air Act, and numerous other rules. The governor also signed into law a measure to regulate the industrial production of hemp, a plant grown legally in more than 30 countries. Production will now be administered by the state's Department of Agriculture, not the Department of Public Health and Environment. Jim Pullen, FSRN, Boulder.
Protesters rallied today in the eight cities where the bankrupt Tribune Company owns newspapers, all of which may be sold to the conservative multi-billionaires Charles and David Koch. Melinda Tuhus reports from Hartford, Connecticut.
Media and community activists say they fear a Koch purchase will turn the papers into mouthpieces for the Koch's views, such as climate change denial, and decimate local coverage critical to a functioning democracy. The Tribune Company currently owns the Chicago Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, the Hartford Courant, the Baltimore Sun, and four other papers. Those papers, in turn, own several smaller regional papers. Cynthia Jennings, a community activist and member of the Hartford City Council with the Working Families Party.
We don't want to give up our right, at least to have an unbiased presentation of the news. I believe that the Hartford Courant is doing more fair reporting, and they're more sensitized to the issues in the community.
Don't sell our daily paper to a news manipulator.
While some groups are attempting to buy just their own local newspaper, an analyst with Free Press says it's in the Tribune Company's interest to sell all eight together, and the Kochs are the most likely buyers, willing to pay an estimated $750 million. A sale is expected in the next few months. Thousands of subscribers have vowed to cancel their subscriptions if the Koch brothers buy the Tribune papers. Melinda Tuhus, Free Speech Radio News, Hartford.
Six former Bosnian Croat officials, including an ex-president, have been sentenced to prison for war crimes committed during the violent breakup of the former Yugoslavia in the early 1990s. The sentences for the former political and military leaders of the Bosnian Croat state range from 10 to 25 years. The judgment found the men deliberately attempted to alter the ethnic makeup of the self-declared state within what is now Bosnia in order to reunite the territory with Croatia. The military campaign they led targeted Bosnian Muslim civilians. The trial was part of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia at The Hague, which began hearing cases in 2006. And those are some of today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The fight for fair wages, respect, and the right to collectively bargain at U.S. corporations continues as workers from Walmart stores across the country walked off the job and started a caravan to Arkansas. There, the retail giant's annual meeting is taking place next week, and workers hope to send a message to shareholders about their working conditions. The walkout could become the longest in the company's history. FSRN's Anna Simonton has more.
2 years ago, nearly 100 Walmart workers from across the country came together in Bentonville, Arkansas, under the name Organization United for Respect at Walmart, or Our Walmart. They presented a declaration of respect to executive management, calling on the company to commit to a list of demands that included listening to and respecting employees, paying a minimum of $13 per hour, providing affordable health care, and respecting the rights of freedom of association and freedom of speech. Cindy Murray has worked as a fitting room associate at a Walmart in Maryland for 13 years and makes $12.40 an hour. She walked out last November during a nationwide Black Friday action. Speaking to FSRN from the caravan to Bentonville, Arkansas, Murray explained why she's taking the risk again.
So to give up a living wage, we could improve the way that we live. We would be able to take care of just some of our basic needs, like we have associates living in cars across the country, in our parking lot.
Murray said that after she and her coworkers walked out on Black Friday, management took them each separately to the lawn and garden section, where they were incorrectly told that their actions were illegal and that further action would bring consequences. The management refused to specify what those consequences would be. Murray says that in spite of retaliation, Our Walmart's organizing efforts have not diminished.
They have fired a few, and we have gotten our jobs back. When Walmart retaliates against one of us, they retaliate against all of us, and we are all standing together.
Others have had similar experiences. The nonprofit advocacy organization, Jobs with Justice American Rights at Work, recently released a report detailing managerial retaliation against Walmart employees across the country. The report describes how workers who have participated in pickets, worn buttons, or in some other way made their affiliation with Our Walmart known have typically been fired or have seen their hours cut and their schedules changed. Erin Johansson, who authored the report, says that now Walmart is going even further.
That's what we've seen before, and so this was, well, really egregious. Their campaign. It was not unsurprising. What was new and surprising to us, and which is also in this report, is how Walmart is now targeting community supporters. They've filed trespass lawsuits in now, uh, I I think it's four states, Arkansas, California, Florida, and Washington. And they're going after the people who are standing with the workers in the picket lines.
Walmart makes about $16 billion a year in profits, while the average Walmart employee earns about $15,000. Walmart did not respond to FSRN's request for an interview. Caravans continue to depart throughout the week, with supporters bringing donations of food and travel supplies to send off rallies. They'll be stopping in cities and towns along the way to pick up more workers and activists and to deliver petitions to Walmart stores and offices as they make their way to Arkansas. Anna Simonton, Free Speech Radio News.
28-year-old Jeremy Hammond pleaded guilty this week in a Manhattan federal court to a charge related to the 2011 computer hacking of the global intelligence firm Stratfor. The guilty plea to one count of conspiracy to engage in computer hacking carries a maximum of 10 years in prison. Hammond must also pay up to $2.5 million in restitution, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. In a statement made public Tuesday, Hammond said he worked with the hacker group Anonymous and released the information on Stratfor because he believed that people have a right to know what governments and corporations are doing behind closed doors. He said he did what he believed is right. Hammond, who has already been held in prison for 15 months, also said he had been denied family visits and had been held for weeks in solitary confinement. Authorities arrested and charged Hammond under the 1984 Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which internet and privacy advocates have criticized as overly broad and out of date. It's also the same law that federal authorities used to investigate and monitor Aaron Swartz, who committed suicide in January. For more, we're joined by Abby Hassan with the National Lawyers Guild. He's also on the defense committee for Hammond. Welcome to FSRN.
Oh, thank you.
Hammond called his plea a non-cooperating guilty plea, which would allow him to speak openly about what he did and why, but does not compel him to tell authorities about the specifics of the tactics he used or who he worked with. What are the conditions of this plea?
So, yeah, I think that's an accurate description, a non-cooperating plea. Basically, with Hammond was what Jeremy Hammond was faced with was very similar to what another young hacker was faced with about 2 years ago by the name of Hector Monsegur, also known as Sabu, and he decided to do something different. Hector decided to go online and, along with the FBI, basically orchestrate an online hacking spree. And as part of that kind of, you know, what most people would think of as an entrapment, but basically FBI and informant orchestrated hacking spree, Jeremy Hammond got caught up in that. And so here we are, he's been in prison now, I mean, he's been in jail now for 15 months, and he decided to take a plea deal, which means he's admitting his guilt, but he's, unlike what Hector did, he is not going to work with the government to try to get other people in trouble. He's not going to talk. He has basically pled guilty in exchange for being exonerated from any other investigation or from having to act as an informant or anything like that.
And that other individual you mentioned, Hector Xavier Monsegur, he was involved in this case as well.
Absolutely. I mean, he's the center of this case. This case, you know, when the FBI had him act as an informant, and again, had him go and elicit others to commit illegal acts across the world, the fruit of that operation and the likely millions of dollars they spent is putting, you know, the activist Jeremy Hammond in jail for up to 10 years.
Well, you mentioned how Jeremy Hammond is just one of others caught up in this operation. He was charged under the same law used to prosecute internet activist Aaron Swartz and other activists, the 1984 Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. There have been recent efforts to amend or change that law. Where does that stand today?
Well, yeah, this law, you know, this is kind of, you know, another example of how this system works, right? You have a law that the CFAA, Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, that basically criminalizes any online activity. If the feds want to go after you on this, that anyone who uses the internet can, they could make a reason for you to be liable under the CFAA. As we saw with Aaron Swartz, the penalties are incredibly disproportionate and unjust. And really, I think we need to have a time to reflect and think what is the criminal law on the internet? What is a crime on the internet? Not this kind of retroactively using these outdated laws to basically what we see to protect corporate interests.
In announcing the plea Tuesday, Manhattan U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara said, and I'll read part of the statement, quote, "While he billed himself as fighting for an anarchist cause, in reality, Jeremy Hammond caused personal and financial chaos for individuals whose identities and money he took and for companies whose businesses he decided he didn't like. He was nothing more than a repeat offender cyber criminal." Abby Hassan with the National Lawyers Guild, your response to that take on the case?
You know, the government wants to portray Jeremy Hammond as some kind of cyber thief who's stealing credit cards. But the fact of the matter is, this company Stratfor had, along with doing all these nefarious spying activities, had incredibly poor security on their customers' database of credit card information, and that was released through the hack. And some other people, and they're not saying that Jeremy did this, some other people spent, you know, they ran up some credit card charges for various charities, kind of as a hoax. Like, it was a hoax kind of thing. And the idea that, you know, this is not grandmas losing their life savings. These are the credit card companies having to pay. And at the end of the day, you know, Stratfor's negligence is as much to blame as anything for the fact that some of those customer credit cards were used.
Jeremy Hammond is scheduled for sentencing on September 6th. There have been efforts in preparation for that. His brother has started a petition. What is next?
So he's taken this plea deal. It was it's 0 to 10 years. So it's not like he has to be sentenced to 10 years. We're having a call. We want some fairness and to ask the judge. You know, he's served enough time. Let him go on time served.
Abby Hassan is with the National Lawyers Guild. He's also on the defense committee for Jeremy Hammond. Hammond is scheduled for sentencing in September. Abby Hassan, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Attorneys for Russell Schoetz, a former Black Panther and member of the Black Liberation Army, have filed a civil rights lawsuit against the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. Schoetz is serving a sentence of life without parole for the 1970 death of a white Philadelphia police sergeant and has been held in solitary confinement for nearly 30 years. FSRN's Peter Rue has more.
Russell Schoetz escaped from prison twice during the first decade of his incarceration. But his supporters say it was his efforts to organize behind prison walls for improved nutrition and medical care that landed him in restrictive housing in 1983. Other than a year and a half stint in federal custody in the early 90s, when he mingled with the general population without incident, Schoetz has called a 64-square-foot cell home for much of the last 30 years.
There are individuals who have adjustment issues where they don't adjust well to a prison setting. They may have incurred continuous misconducts against staff, against other inmates. So when misconducts are gotten like that, they can be placed in the restricted housing unit for discipline for a period of time.
Sue McNaughton is a representative for Pennsylvania's Department of Corrections.
However, there are some individuals who, over their course of incarceration, continue to be problematic inmates with regard to, you know, the safety of staff and other inmates, and require being housed in the restricted housing unit for longer periods of time.
Out of a total U.S. prison population of more than 2 million people, about 80,000 are held in one form of solitary confinement or another, according to figures compiled by the American Civil Liberties Union. The rights group considers long-term isolation a form of torture and says it is often imposed on inmates arbitrarily. Prisoners in a number of states have used hunger strikes to protest solitary confinement, including thousands who launched a mass protest at California facilities in 2011. Prisoners there say their demands for more humane treatment have still not been met, and recently announced plans to resume the protest this July. In Pennsylvania, the state's Department of Corrections declined to comment on the specifics of Schott's case, but said the terms of his confinement have come under periodic review over the years, and each time, prison authorities have opted to keep him in isolation. Schott supporters say the department is motivated by a fear of the 69-year-old's ideology more than any threat of violence. For decades, since the movement for racial and economic justice that Schott was a part of rose and fell, he remains one of 19 former Panthers still incarcerated today, according to the National Alumni Association of the Black Panther Party. The group estimates Panthers have served a combined total of more than 800 years behind bars. Professor Joanna Fernandez teaches history at Baruch College in Manhattan. She says it is important to understand the times through which Schott and other Panthers lived in order to face the present.
What we see happening is that politicians, the FBI, and its COINTELPRO program have successfully created a panic around crime, a moral panic around crime, and the targets of that moral panic are Black radicals. And a huge number of them are incarcerated.
Fernandez says the paranoia used to justify the repression of the Panthers was later extended to repress the broader Black community, as racism Black radicals had challenged reconstituted itself in the war on drugs.
On that edifice or scaffolding of the 1960s, we see the edifice of mass incarceration emerging in the 1970s and 80s. And now there's a slight shift away from Black radicals and to all of the African American community through the war on drugs.
Mass incarceration of people of color has led to social and economic impacts on families, splitting them apart and taking away an income earner. Russell Schott's daughter, Teresa, says it took her most of her life to come to terms with her father's legacy.
It wasn't until about 10 years ago I questioned him about how could you leave your family. He said that it was for the love of his people. These are his exact words. He stood on the front line to protect me and the future generations. In my generation. So, you know, I always tell people it hit me like a ton of bricks. I could do nothing but help them.
As a result of solitary confinement, Teresa Schott says her father suffers from post-traumatic stress, and, since the lights perpetually glow in his restrictive housing unit, sleep deprivation. She hoped that her father's recent transfer from State Corrections Institute Green signaled a shift in the terms of his confinement, but authorities at SEI My Hanoi have continued to hold Schott in solitary. On May 8th, Schott's attorneys filed a civil rights lawsuit against Pennsylvania's Secretary of Corrections, John Wetzel, and superintendents at Green and My Hanoi, accusing the state of violating constitutional prohibitions against cruel and unusual punishment. While the lawsuit makes its way through the docket of Pennsylvania's Western District Court, Teresa Schott is urging sympathizers to write or call Secretary Wetzel and demand her father be placed in the general population. Her hope is that the generation Schott stood up for will stand up for him, and perhaps one day win his compassionate release.
When it comes to the prison system, it's baby steps, step by step, unless, that's clear, let me correct it. Unless the people, who the same people he fought for, the people make the move to free Russell.
While Schott remains behind bars, last month his collected prison writings made their way onto bookstore shelves. Most were authored while in solitary confinement, using the sole writing utensil at his disposal, a pencil. The book covers a wide range of topics beyond Black liberation. Feminism, Occupy Wall Street, even ecology, though Schott has been allowed few glimpses of the natural world for the last 40 years. One essay begins with a quote from the Algerian revolutionary Frantz Fanon. Each generation must, out of relative obscurity, discover its mission, fulfill it, or betray it. Peter Rue, FSRN.
Fallout from the financial scandal that hit the interest rate setting measure known as LIBOR continues to affect borrowers and investors. Some of them filed lawsuits after the bank's wrongdoing came to light in 2012, including suits by the city of Baltimore and a group of homeowners. Now California's largest public employee union wants the state to investigate J.P. Morgan Chase and other major banks linked to LIBOR and consider suing to recover billions in lost investment dollars. From Sacramento, FSRN's Max Pringle reports.
More than 100 SEIU Local 1000 members recently marched and rallied in downtown Sacramento at the office of CalPERS, the state's public employee retirement system, and at the main Chase Bank branch, where they plastered the door with Post-it notes.
They say things like, they're like, give us our money, I accuse, hear us, the banks owe us. Some just say one word like fraud.
Jim Heron-Zamora is an SEIU Local 1000 spokesperson. The local wants the state to set up a task force to delve into the losses Californians suffered under the LIBOR, or London Interbank Offered Rate, scandal, in which up to 16 major international banks colluded to raise or lower interest rates to make a profit, or to give the false impression of creditworthiness. U.S. banks, like Chase, have yet to face major legal challenges in California for their role in the scandal.
Essentially, they gamed it. To benefit themselves for billions and billions of dollars. The fraud was huge.
Barclays Bank, the Royal Bank of Scotland, and other banks tied to the scandal have paid out about $2.5 billion to settle suits in U.S. and U.K. courts. SEIU Local 1000 wants CalPERS, America's largest public employee retirement fund, and the state of California to be as aggressive as other public agencies in pursuing the banks. Jim Zamora.
We are taxpayers and we are state employees, and that's our money, and we want to see it back.
J.P. Morgan Chase declined to comment on Local 1000's claims, as did State Attorney General Kamala Harris's office. CalPERS spokesperson Joe DeAnda left the door open for possible legal action. He said in a statement that they are, quote, continuing to evaluate the impact of CalPERS and will take appropriate action if necessary. Although it's unclear how much investment income workers lost, SEIU Local 1000 President Yvonne Walker hopes CalPERS follows through with some action. She says her members lost funds, which they trusted with the banks, might have been used for more productive investments.
That's money that could have been used in our communities through infrastructure bonds and everything else. But ultimately, we think the banks should pay. We think they should give our money back for their bad business practices and their bad investment advice and everything else.
SEIU Local 1000 and the state are locked in contentious contract negotiations. Retirement security is one of the key issues in the talks. Max Pringle, FSRN, Sacramento.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Shannon Young. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Shauna Ray. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.